Divided Loyalties, Civil War Documents from the Missouri State Archives.
The Archives is a division of Missouri Secretary of State Robin Carnahan's office and is the official repository for state records of permanent and historical value. We hope you enjoy your time with us today.
Slavery in Missouri dates back to the 1720s. The first slaves in Missouri were brought to the state by French settlers and primarily worked in the lead mines south of St. Louis. Most slaves came to Missouri after the Louisiana Purchase and became an important part of the tobacco economy of the early 19th century. Initially, both African Americans and American Indians were enslaved until the state outlawed the enslavement of Indian people in 1834. Slavery in Missouri became a particularly heated issue when Missouri requested statehood in 1820. The U.S. Congress was concerned that the admission of Missouri to the Union would unbalance the number of slave and free states in the Union. Speaker Henry Clay helped craft a compromise in which Missouri was admitted as a slave state and Maine was admitted as a free state. With the passage of this Missouri Compromise, slavery was prohibited north of Missouri's southern border. In Missouri, there was a fierce debate over whether Congress had the right to decide the issue of slavery for the states. This 1819 petition by the citizens of St. Charles to the members of Missouri's territorial delegation to Congress argued that Congress did not have that right. This 1863 bill of sale advertises slaves ranging in age from 7 months to 45 years. Many families were split up in this manner. Age and infirmity did not prevent slaves from being sold at auction. As this panel demonstrates, the issue of slavery was foremost in the minds of many Missourians on the eve of the Civil War. When Congress considered legislation to organize the territories of Nebraska and Kansas, pro-slavery citizens opposed the measure because the territory would have been free due to the stipulations of the Missouri Compromise. Congress passed the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, proposed by Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, which allowed the people in those territories to decide the question of slavery on their own. This panel features an image of the original copy of an Act to Organize the Territories of Nebraska and Kansas, commonly known as the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which is housed in the National Archives. While many in Missouri favored the admission of Kansas as a slave state, anti-slavery forces were equally determined to see the state admitted as free of slavery. Violence multiplied along the Kansas-Missouri border. Kansas Free Soilers, like John Brown and James Montgomery, led raids against pro-slavery settlers who led their own raids against the Free Soilers. Missouri Senator David Rice Acheson even led about 1,000 armed pro-slavery Missourians into Kansas to vote in elections that would determine the fate of Kansas and to prevent Free Soilers from voting. Kansas was finally admitted to the Union as a free state on January 29, 1861, in the midst of the secession crisis. The documents on this panel show the intensity of this conflict, which prompted Missouri Governor Robert Marcellus Stewart to send troops to protect citizens in border towns a full 7 months before the outbreak of the war. The Constitution of the state of Missouri has evolved many times over the years. In fact, Missourians have had four different constitutions since becoming a state in 1821. This panel shows pages from the original 1820 Constitution. This Constitution, among other things, precluded the General Assembly from passing laws freeing slaves or laws prohibiting the importation of slaves from other states or territories. It also gave the General Assembly power to make laws governing the emancipation of slaves by their owners and the circumstances under which freed slaves could settle in the state. These provisions reveal the political climate in the state with regards to slavery. Slaves in Missouri were sometimes freed by their masters. Often, this freedom came with stipulations. For example, some slaves were required to purchase their freedom from their masters. One such slave, a woman named Elizabeth Keckley, was able to buy freedom for herself and her son for the price of $1,200. She went on to work as a successful seamstress in Washington, D.C., for prominent women like Mary Todd Lincoln and Verena Davis, wife of Jefferson Davis. Freed slaves residing in Missouri had to carry free licenses, like the one featured on this panel, to prove they had been emancipated. These were precious documents. A slave who lost these papers or had them stolen was vulnerable to re-enslavement. The petition for freedom shown on this panel is from the Dred Scott case, a landmark Supreme Court case involving two Missouri residents, Dred and Harriet Scott. The Scotts had previously resided in the Free State of Illinois and the Free Territory of Wisconsin before moving to Missouri. Missouri courts traditionally abided by the doctrine, once free, always free. On this basis, the Scotts sued for their freedom. Missouri courts agreed that the Scots should be free, but in March of 1857, the Supreme Court reversed the decision. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Roger B. Taney, declared that no African American could ever be a citizen of the United States and that the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional. thus permitting slavery in all the territories. This decision was one of the most controversial in the history of the Supreme Court. Dred Scott refused to be discouraged by the court's attitude, commenting, "My hopes were never brighter than now." Scott knew that the nationwide attention his case had received might one day lead toward abolition and freedom for all slaves. Dred Scott was freed by new owners 9 months before his death on September 17, 1858. In 1849, almost 30 years after Missouri's admission to the Union, and 8 years before the Dred Scott decision, the issue of whether the state or federal government should make laws concerning slavery was still being hotly debated in the U.S. Congress. The Missouri State Legislature felt it should decide this issue for the state, and passed the Jackson resolutions to that effect. The resolutions instructed the state's congressional delegation how to vote on the matter of whether slavery would be allowed in new territories. Missouri Senator Thomas Hart Benton believed the issue should be decided by Congress and refused to abide by the resolutions. As a result, he lost his 1850 reelection campaign to Whig Henry S. Geyer. This sentiment was also reflected at the national level in the 1860 presidential election, in which Lincoln did not win a single southern or border state. The documents on this panel illustrate how events rapidly escalated towards war in 1860 and 1861. In his 1860 campaign for governor, Claiborne Fox Jackson presented himself as a moderate candidate on the issue of slavery. However, after he was elected, he became more openly pro-Southern. In the same year, Southern states began to secede from the Union, and the Missouri General Assembly called for a convention to decide which side Missouri would take. The convention met in St. Louis for 18 days in February of 1861 and decided to remain in the Union. The delegates were keeping a watch on the neighboring states of Tennessee, Kentucky, and Arkansas, which were still in the Union, and resolved to meet again should these conditions change. An image of Governor Jackson's inaugural address is featured on this panel. In this speech, Governor Jackson clearly stated that he believed Missouri's interests would best be served by allying with Southern states. The Act to Provide for the Calling of a State Convention, featured here, sets forth the conditions for the State Convention of 1861. Governor Jackson and his supporters in the General Assembly fled the state capital, which Lyon and his troops took possession of. Subsequently, Lyon and Jackson's forces clashed at Boonville and Carthage before meeting at the decisive Battle of Wilson's Creek. Jackson called his government in exile into session first at Neosho and later at Cassville. The self-described rebel legislature passed an article of secession, shown here, and a provisional constitution, and on November 28, 1861, the state of Missouri was admitted to the Confederacy. In July 1861, the delegates of the state convention met again in response to Governor Jackson's flight from the Capitol and declared all statewide offices vacant. Hamilton Gamble, a former Missouri Supreme Court judge, was elected provisional governor by the convention. The image shown here is Governor Gamble's inaugural address, in which he stressed the need to avoid involvement in the rapidly escalating national conflict. Unfortunately, Governor Gamble's warning had no effect, and the war expanded to adversely affect every Missouri family. This panel provides details for early Missouri battles. They are listed as follows in chronological order. 1. The Battle of Boonville, June 17, 1861. 2. The Battle of Carthage, July 5, 1861. 3. The Battle of Wilson's Creek, August 19, 1861. 4. The Battle of Lexington, September 18 through 20, 1861. Missouri ranked third among states in number of military actions fought during the Civil War, although few of these actions were large-scale battles. In the summer and fall of 1864, Confederate guerrillas attacked the citizens of northern Missouri with renewed intensity in an attempt to draw Union troops away from the state's southern border so that General Sterling Price could make a last attempt to win Missouri. This last attempt began in September 1864 as Price's forces moved north from Arkansas. On September 26th and 27th, Price and 12,000 men attacked the 1,400 Union troops stationed at Fort Davidson in Pilot Knob, Missouri. The Union troops were forced to flee, but managed to inflict heavy losses on Price's troops and delayed his advance so that Federal forces had time to mobilize. In addition, the battle did not give Price any strategic advantage. turned away from St. Louis and Jefferson City, Price fled west before being caught between two Union forces at Westport. The resulting battle is sometimes known as the Gettysburg of the West and marked the beginning of the end for Price's efforts in the West. Union forces defeated Price, who continued to flee south. His goals of winning Missouri for the Confederacy and swaying the fall elections in favor of the Confederacy were not realized, and the campaign marked the end of organized Confederate resistance in Missouri. The hardships of battle were compounded by a labor shortage. Most of the troops who fought in Missouri, as elsewhere in the war, were average citizens rather than professional soldiers, and when these men were called into battle, local farms and businesses suffered. The muster roll shown on this panel tells us that women also served in the military as cooks and nurses in the military hospitals. Women were not allowed to serve in the military forces, although a few did disguise themselves as men in order to participate. The group of Missouri State Archives documents featured on this panel allows us to follow one soldier, John V., from the time of his enlistment in the U.S. Reserve Corps in St. Louis through his service in the enrolled Missouri Militia. V. was killed during the final days of Price's campaign in Missouri while serving on an escort detail aboard the steamer Isabella. Famous Missourians felt the call to service as strongly as average citizens did. Among others, Missouri's most well-known painter, George Caleb Bingham, served as a captain in the U.S. Volunteer Reserve Corps and later became state treasurer of the provisional government. Samuel Clemens, pen name Mark Twain, joined the Confederate militia for 2 weeks at the beginning of the war before going west to California in search of gold. After the 1863 Emancipation Proclamation, the 1st Regiment of Missouri Colored Infantry was formed. It immediately attracted 300 African Americans. Another African American unit belonged to the enrolled Missouri Militia and was based in Hannibal. In Missouri, which is a slaveholding border state, was exempt from the Emancipation Proclamation, the Union Army recruited slaves from both anti-Union slave owners and from loyal slave owners as well. The muster rolls featured on this panel show that some African American troops enrolled as residents of Canada, England, and Jamaica. These troops often suffered from a lack of supplies since priority was given to white soldiers. All of the accounts on this panel are from the white officers who commanded the colored units, since literacy was not widespread among slaves. You may also have noticed that the accounts we have presented up until now are mostly from a pro-Union perspective. This panel presents a few of the Confederate documents housed in the Missouri State Archives. Because the pro-Southern state government fled Jefferson City to southern Missouri and later Texas, not many of its records made it back to Jefferson City after the war ended. One Confederate soldier, a Tennessean named Ephraim McDowell Anderson, is unusually well documented. McDowell participated in the defense of Vicksburg, Mississippi, where he was captured along with 30,000 of his fellow soldiers. General Grant paroled them, not expecting the starving soldiers to be capable of fighting again. In fact, Anderson rejoined his unit a year later, but was plagued by chronic illness and received a furlough, as shown by the medical release and military passes depicted here. During the war, bands of Union and Confederate sympathizers roamed the country, harassing civilians. Often these bands were no more than outlaws using the war as an excuse to plunder and kill. Sometimes citizens would band together to protect their communities from these marauders. The resolution shown on this panel is from the citizens of Gentry County, dated September 4, 1863, pledging to form one of these companies. The letter featured on this panel is in response to a perceived increase in guerrilla attacks in northwest Missouri. In response to a perceived increase in guerrilla attacks in northwest Missouri, Brigadier General Clinton B. Fisk writes to Second Lieutenant Thomas J. Tidswell requesting 2,000 troops to defend against these attacks. Both the Confederate and Union troops tried to impose their views on the people. The Union-backed provisional government declared martial law in effect. This meant, among other things, that Missourians had to have a military pass in order to travel. In order to get a pass, you had to take an oath of loyalty to the Union. Martial law remained in effect for most of the war. The Confiscation Act of 1862, shown on this panel, was an attempt by the federal government to punish Confederate sympathizers. This act declared that any slaves encountered by the Union Army whose owners were rebels would be freed immediately. This was a first step toward emancipation. However, it did not grant the freed slaves any civil rights. Vigilantes, who were often soldiers, often terrorized the citizenry, imposing harsh punishments or even death for anyone who chose the wrong side. The depositions featured on this panel are from witnesses of alleged assaults carried out by Militia Captain H.R. Parson. Missourians faced forced conscription, discrimination, and a disrupted government. A person's political views could often determine how easy or hard life was, or even whether you lived or died. The group of documents featured on this panel describe how men in Cape Girardeau and Mississippi County were forced into military service by the Union Army. The letter shown on this panel relates how a woman in Jefferson City was evicted by her landlady for being a Union sympathizer. Elsewhere, courts were suspended and government buildings were burned. Even the state mental hospital was closed. This degree of chaos is hard to imagine, but it was a daily fact of life for Missourians at this time.
This panel and the next display a timeline of Missouri Civil War companies.
An unusually high number of different military units originated in Missouri. They are listed here in chronological order by date of formation. April 15, 1861. 3 months Missouri Militia or Missouri Volunteers. April 30, 1861. United States Reserve Corps, 3 months. May 3, 1861. Missouri Volunteers, Infantry. June 11, 1861. Home Guards. August 12, 1861. United States Reserve Corps, 3 years. August 24, 1861. 6 or 12 months. Missouri Volunteers. August 24, 1861. 6 months Missouri Militia. July 22, 1862. Enrolled Missouri Militia. February 3, 1863. Provisional Enrolled Missouri Militia. August 25, 1863. Citizens Guards. June 28, 1864. Provisional Companies of Enrolled Missouri Militia, also Enrolled Missouri Militia. January 30, 1865, Missouri Militia, General Orders No. 3. February 10, 1865, Missouri Militia. Not all enlisted Missourians fought within the state. Many in both the Confederate and Union armies followed the call of duty outside Missouri's borders. The documents on this page illustrate their involvement and how they fared so far away from home. The three regiments of Missouri Volunteers featured on this panel fought with Union General William Tecumseh Sherman on his march to the sea in the fall of 1864. In a report to the Missouri Adjutant General's office, Lieutenant Colonel Quinn Morton calls it the greatest raid the world has ever known. Many Missourians were killed or wounded far from home. Volunteer organizations like the Sanitary Commission and the Christian Commission were largely responsible for the care and or burial of these troops. The letter featured on this panel is from Missouri Volunteer William Butler to Governor Gamble, describing the conditions he encountered. The issue of federal authority versus state authority was divisive not only nationally. It also divided the ranks within the Union troops. The enrolled Missouri militia and other state militia units answered to state authority and were bound by state laws, while the Missouri Volunteers and other federally supported troops were controlled by U.S. civil and military authority and laws. An organization such as the Missouri State Militia fell in between, a state militia authorized and equipped by the national government and commanded by a federal officer. As the letters on this panel show, Governor Gamble believed state forces answered to state laws. The Union troops disagreed on what stance to take towards slaves. Federal troops would often free slaves and aid escaped slaves, while state troops often returned escaped slaves to their owners. Although Robert E. Lee surrendered the Army of Northern Virginia to U.S. Grant at Appomattox Courthouse on April 9, 1865, fighting continued on some fronts for weeks afterward. In Missouri, a convention was called in St. Louis to legalize the abolition of slavery. Charles Drake, one of the convention delegates, convinced his fellow delegates that the entire Missouri Constitution needed to be rewritten in order to help Missouri make slavery a thing of the past. This so-called Drake Constitution included a requirement that all Missourians who wish to vote, hold public office, teach, or be the trustee of a corporation must take an oath of loyalty, swearing that they had never supported the Southern cause in any way or had even spoken in favor of it. As you might imagine, this ironclad oath disenfranchised large numbers of people. The documents on this panel pertain to the Drake Constitution. Many of them were damaged in a 1911 fire in the state capitol. The ironclad oath became yet another fault line in an already fractured society. Frank Blair was an ardent opponent of the oath, despite his early and unwavering support of the Union as a congressman and general in the Union Army. Blair attempted to vote after submitting a signed copy of his own version of the loyalty oath. Since his oath did not match the one prescribed by the Drake Constitution, his ballot was rejected. Blair challenged the decision all the way to the United States Supreme Court. The court failed to reach a majority, and thus the oath remained a part of the Missouri Constitution until it was removed in 1870, with the repudiation of radical rule at the polls. The documents on this panel are from the original petition filed in 1866 by Frank Blair in the St. Louis Circuit Court. As might be expected, the disenfranchisement of a large portion of the population had significant effect on Missouri elections. The documents on this panel show the election returns for Boone County, Missouri, in August 1860 and November 1868. In the 1860 election, 2,600 voters went to the polls. William Switzler, a member of the 1865 Constitutional Convention who had opposed the oath, claimed that in 1866, all but 878 of the county's 5,000 eligible voters had been prevented from voting, and that this abuse of power engendered a great bitterness of feeling, sometimes approaching the verge of personal violence. In 1868, 350 voters went to the polls. Some took the enforcement of the oath even further. Union military veteran George Easley sued Linn County Registration Officer Harvey Walk for preventing him from voting, even though Easley was willing to sign the ironclad oath. Easley claims Walk asked him 36 additional questions, which are shown on this panel, and denied his right to vote because of alleged disloyalty acts committed during the war. The pages featured on this panel are from an 1866 lawsuit filed by Easley in Linn County Circuit Court for $10,000 in damages. The court dismissed the suit on the grounds that Easley had not shown sufficient cause. Confederate and Union soldiers were held for real or alleged crimes during the war. Even after the war's end, 157 pro-Union civilians and soldiers remained in the Missouri State Penitentiary until the state government ordered them to be set free a full 8 months after the end of the war. George Perkins, a member of the enrolled Missouri militia, shot an intoxicated man who had stabbed him while resisting arrest. Perkins was convicted of assault with intent to kill and sentenced to 4 years in the state penitentiary. In the letter featured on this panel, Perkins unsuccessfully applies for a pardon from Missouri Governor Thomas Fletcher. In another letter shown on this panel, the victim's brother offers support for Perkins' actions, saying his brother was habitually intoxicated. The war brought all types of heartbreak on Missouri families. When Michael Brennan, desperate for a job, decided to join a union company from Clarksville, his wife tried to prevent him from leaving. As he attempted to walk out the door, Brennan shoved his wife out of the way. She fell off the porch and died of a ruptured blood vessel near her heart. In the letter reproduced on this panel, B.P. Clifford asks Governor Gamble to pardon Brennan from his sentence of manslaughter. General John Schofield, commanding officer of the Union Army's District of Missouri, thought that the best way to compensate loyal citizens for damages during the war was to make disloyal citizens pay for them. He enacted this philosophy with General Order No. 3, which called for the creation of county boards to collect compensation. If a citizen refused, their property was seized and sold. One instance of this type of property seizure is represented on this panel in this statement filed in the Supreme Court of Missouri. In Wright v. Tallman, William Wright sued for damages incurred when the Miller County Board seized his property as a result of the death of an enrolled Missouri militiaman and the injury of another. These lawsuits were not limited to Northern v. Southern sympathizers. George Caleb Bingham, a well-known Missouri artist and a vocal supporter of the Union, was involved in such a lawsuit. A petition for damages filed by Willis C. Ransom against George Caleb Bingham is shown on this panel. Bingham admitted that he had made public comments holding Ransom responsible for allowing his men to steal and destroy property from Missouri citizens, but denied using the words attributed to him in court documents. The suit was eventually dismissed. This panel features a painting by Bingham titled Order No. 11, which was Bingham's protest against the order of the same name issued by Union General Thomas Ewing. Ewing ordered all residents of Bates, Cass, and Jackson counties and part of Vernon County to vacate the area in order to remove the civilians harboring and supporting the guerrillas. As Union and Confederate troops moved across the country during the war, they often took food and supplies and destroyed property belonging to citizens. Union troops were supposed to write receipts for supplies they took, to be repaid by the federal government after the war. Making a claim was often difficult, especially without a receipt. It was even more challenging, if not impossible, to obtain repayment from the Confederate government, which dissolved after the war. As a result, many citizens took individuals who had served in the Confederate Army to court for compensation. Pages from a petition for damages by four businessmen from Ironton are represented on this panel. The plaintiffs accused 55 Confederate leaders of conspiracy to overthrow the government, which in turn led to the damage inflicted on their businesses. The businessmen lost their suit. One infamous murder during the war was that of Obadiah Smith, a Baptist minister and Missouri state representative. A band of bushwhackers dressed as Union troops fooled Smith into surrendering his weapon. Confederates suspected Smith of helping Union General Jim Lane burn the town of Osceola, Missouri in 1861 and murdered Smith in retaliation in April 1863. The documents featured on this panel are from an 1866 lawsuit in which the administrator of Obadiah Smith's estate sued Amos Beck and 12 other defendants for damages inflicted on Smith's estate. He was awarded $12,000 in damages. One of the documents reproduced on this panel is the plaintiff's petition from the state of Missouri v. James E. Head. James Calhoun asserted that Head had taunted him by claiming to have been the person who fired the shot that killed his father, William. William had been murdered 11 years earlier by Company E of the enrolled Missouri militia for failing to provide knowledge of the whereabouts of local bushwhackers. Thomas Clement Fletcher became governor of Missouri in the final days of the war. In order to control the vigilante violence, he deployed cavalry and infantry units to various parts of the state. Fletcher was attacked by the editors of the Missouri Republican, who claimed the troops were inflicting more violence than the rebels. The petition shown on this panel is from the resulting lawsuit in which Fletcher sued for libel. Both parties eventually agreed to drop the suit and pay their own court costs. Notorious outlaws Frank and Jesse James began their careers as Confederate guerrillas in Missouri. The documents on this panel detail some of their criminal history. One of the first court cases against the brothers was a civil case filed in Davies County in 1870. Daniel Smoot alleged that the brothers stole a horse, bridle, and saddle as they fled the robbery of the Davies County Savings Association on December 7, 1869. Frank and Jesse failed to appear in court, so Smoot won the case. There is no evidence that Smoot ever received compensation from the brothers. The pages represented on this panel are from the February 1882 indictment of Frank James for the murder of conductor William Westfall during a train robbery at Winston. Frank was acquitted. The James brothers directed most of their crimes against Union supporters and radical Republicans, and because of this were regarded as heroes by many of Missouri's defeated Confederates. As you might imagine, there were also plenty of people who wanted them stopped. The April 1875 letter to Governor Charles Hardin shown on this panel asked the governor to do something to protect the innocent and law-abiding from highway robbers and murderers. In July 1881, Governor Thomas Crittenden issued a proclamation, shown here, offering a reward of $5,000 for the arrest of Frank and Jesse James. On April 3, 1882, Bob Ford, an acquaintance of Jesse's, murdered Jesse in his home in St. Joseph. 2 weeks later, the governor pardoned Ford. The photo featured on this panel was taken in 1912 and shows Frank James in front of his home in Kearney, Missouri. Frank surrendered to Governor Crittenden and was put on trial, but swayed the jurors with recollections of how hard life was during the war and was acquitted. He lived to old age, enjoying his status as a celebrated former outlaw. Francis Rodman served as Missouri's Secretary of State from 1865 to 1871. He was accused of using his position as top elections official to influence elections to the benefit of his fellow Republicans. In 1868, the Daily Missouri Republican printed a story claiming Rodman and several friends had performed a mock baptism in a Jefferson City saloon. Rodman sued for libel, as shown in the plaintiff's petition on this panel. While Rodman won the suit, he filed for bankruptcy and left the state after the end of his term. The newspaper clipping, reproduced on this panel, tells the story of Colonel T.H. Malden, a lawyer assigned to file a claim for reimbursement for damages caused to the Stoddard County Courthouse by federal troops during the war. Malden forged a receipt for the money, and it was only discovered 32 years later that he had stolen the funds. Despite the social upheaval of the Civil War, Missouri politics soon returned to something very similar to pre-war status. Even though the radical Republicans had taken drastic steps to disenfranchise Southern sympathizers, by 1873, all but one of the statewide elected officials were Democrats. The document featured on this panel is the roll call sheet for the Constitutional Convention of 1875, in which the delegates strengthened the power of the governor and weakened the legislature. Though the state and federal governments were in disarray for many years after the war, attempts were made to care for veterans. This panel features a letter from Clara Barton, who was widely known for her work as a battlefield nurse. She continued to work on behalf of soldiers after the war's end as a director of the Office of Correspondence with the Friends of Missing Men. Barton's efforts located 22,000 missing men by 1869. By 1890, federal laws had made any Union veteran of the Civil War who had been honorably discharged, had served for at least 90 days, and suffered from a disability eligible for a pension. Most Southern states had enacted pensions for the Confederate soldiers by the 1890s, but Missouri did not do so until 1911. The list shown on this panel names eligible Confederate veterans from the year 1929. Documents of lasting historical significance are susceptible to fire, water, oxidization, and the natural decomposition that comes with aging. It is the job of archivists to preserve and provide access to these records. One way to provide access to records is to digitize them. One of the photos featured on this panel shows imaging technician Stacy White using a planetary scanner to make a digital copy of a Civil War document. These documents are available to the public at no cost on the State Archives Missouri Digital Heritage website at www.missouridigitalheritage.com. Archivists use humidity and gentle pressure to flatten documents that have been folded, as shown in the photograph on this panel. This process was used on many of the more than 230,000 St. Louis court documents from the Civil War era that have been preserved by the State Archives. Field archivists from the Missouri State Archives Local Records Program help local government agencies evaluate and preserve documents in their collections. The Civil War era map of the city of Palmyra, featured on this panel, is one of the many documents that have been conserved in the Archives Lab.
This concludes the audio tour of Divided Loyalties, Civil War Documents from the Missouri State Archives. We hope you enjoyed your time with us today. If you would like to explore these documents further, please go to www.missouridigitalheritage.com or call the State Archives at 573-751-3280. For more information about Wolfner Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, please call 1-800-392-2614 or visit www.sos.mo.gov/Wolfner.